Well, since your last book was a collection of stories, If the River Was Whiskey, which was favorably reviewed, and you seem to be coming out with the material at a more rapid pace than ever before.
Well, I'm planning on giving the public a little rest now, and myself, too. This East is East was particularly fun for me to write. I can't say that about all of my books. I shot through this one in about 14 months, which is a record for me. I had hoped that I would have that initial rush of interest in the story and not have it flag in the middle. I think the middles are the toughest thing to do when you're writing books. This one happily seemed to just sort of turn itself out. I'm going to take about 2 years on my new project, though, which I have already started.
A project? You mean a book?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what the first girl always says. She's always working on projects. And I said, what project do you mean?
Actually, I meant with an erector set, and I'm going to... No, yeah, I'm working on a book about John Harvey Kellogg, one of the founders of our health movement in the United States. And in order to do the research for this, I took my wife on a romantic trip to Battle Creek, Michigan this summer.
Oh, that Kellogg.
Sure, anybody can go to...
Kellogg's Pep.
Sure, anybody can go to Monte Carlo or Paris, but I took her to Battle Creek, Michigan.
That's such romantic... name, you know, Battle Creek. You can see Indians.
It does derive actually from a battle with Indians on that site.
Well, I want to be held in suspense because in 2 years maybe we can, if I'm still around, we can still chat about that. Well, let's talk about East is East. This was really, it was a funny book, very fast moving and very poignant at the same time. What gave you the idea to put this Chinaman as some of the natives in the book referred to your anti-hero. What gave you this idea?
Well, I have to tell you a little anecdote about friendship in order to give you the answer to that question. One of my dear old friends from San Francisco, a guy I've known all my life, came down to L.A. when I was had moved into a new house, new for me, but an old house that needed some repairs. I'm kind of inept at repairing things. He came down unasked with his truck full of tools and started to whack away and hammer things and so on. While he was in the midst of this, he looked over his shoulder and he said, "Oh, by the way, I have the idea for your next book." And he told me about a news article he had read. And in the news article, an Asian man had jumped ship somewhere in the south of the United States, been at large for 6 weeks, and was then captured and deported. And when he was captured, he was a mass of pustules and, bleeding cuts and insect bites and so on. Well, I thanked my friend because this was right up my alley, obviously, particularly the pus and the muck and the swamps.
Now, you're a specialist in pustules.
That's exactly right. And I was working on World's End at the time, which took me 3 years to write. And I said, all right, I'll work on this eventually. 2 books later, after If the River Was Whiskey, I turned to my friend and I said, well, Rob... what about that story? He couldn't find it, nor could I. So I decided to interpolate, and I chose a Japanese as my Asian man, because like most of America in the last decade or so, I've been fascinated with Japan and Japanese culture, not to mention living in L.A., which of course is permeated by Japanese culture. I chose Georgia because I have some good friends there. I love the town of Savannah. And I love the Sea Islands off of Georgia where it was set, and, of course, where the climactic scene takes place in the Okefenokee Swamp. That's something I'd always dreamed of visiting when I was a boy growing up in the frozen wasteland of Westchester County.
Yeah, the setting is very good. I wondered about how you got that, and I can see that you've been there.
Well, I made a grueling research trip with three of my drunken bachelor buddies, and we stayed in the Homerville Motel in the dry county of Clinch.
How did you get through that?
It was tough. You know how we got through it? The hotel fortunately gave on to the one hot spot in town, which was the local Dairy Queen. And it seemed that everyone in town, of all ages, would cruise the Dairy Queen perpetually. That's all they did. I don't know if they worked or had jobs or what they did, but they always kept cruising. We happened to be driving an old, battered Lincoln Continental with Muskogee County plates. So we cruised the Dairy Queen, too. It's exciting, very exciting.
Yeah, that reminds me of McAllister, Oklahoma, where the highlight, well, it has two highlights, the Oklahoma State Prison and the Dairy Queen just outside of town. I know because we always drove through McAllister on the way to my grandfather's, well, I was going to say farm, but they call them ranches out there.
Yeah, once you get past the Mississippi, I guess they become ranches, don't they?
Now, you say a lot about the writing life because on an island off the Georgia coast, you said a writer's colony. And have you been to a writer's colony?
Well, I have to confess to being a virgin vis-a-vis writer's colonies. No, I've never been to one, and I guess after people read the book, I'll never be asked either. I do have some experience of how young writers, particularly like my heroine, Ruth Dershowitz, can feel insecure and can get caught up more in the politics of a writing community than in the writing itself. And my experience of that sort of thing derives from my student days at the University of Iowa's Writers Workshop, which is, of course, amenable to writers, but also highly competitive. And I think I just used my experience there and imagined a writer's colony. Several reviewers have theorized, actually have accused me of taking pot shots at various existing writers, or bounty hunting, as one put it. But the fact is, I invented these writers and this colony and have never been to one.
Yeah, you have a number of writers at the colony who have very, very specific personalities. And there seems to be a lot of jockeying for power, who's going to be the doyen of the colony and this sort of thing. But apparently that was also the case at Iowa.
To an extent. I don't want to overplay it. Of course, it didn't affect me. I, with Olympian disdain, was far above anything like that, of course. But, yeah, I think it does. That sort of thing does go on. In these sections of the novel that you're referring to, Don, I was trying to do something along the lines of what one of my great heroes, Evelyn Waugh, might have done with a closed society of people. And the writers you mention are, I think, sort of representative of types of writing. We have Irving Thalamus, the great legend of Jewish American letters. We have Laura Grobian, the doyen of the haunted-eyed, pale wasp novelists from the coast, whose whole fame rests on the 191-page trilogy she'd written called San Francisco Light. If these characters sound familiar, I think maybe they are fictional representations of types of writers that we have in our society.
Yeah, I almost went to Breadloaf this past summer. As a matter of fact, I reserved August for that purpose, and then at the last minute I decided,
yeah, I understand.
Maybe next year.
Yeah, I have never been to Breadloaf either. Well, I've never been to any of them, but I understand that there is a real hierarchy there of the more established writers and their students, the secondary or beginning writers and their students, and then, of course, just the students themselves. You know, I mean, I think this kind of hierarchy does exist, and so it was kind of fun to posit my own in this
but
colony.
But you're teaching, still teaching, aren't you?
I teach at USC, yes. It's a grueling schedule. I go in 54 afternoons a year, and I do enjoy it very much. Several of my students live here in New York now. They came to graduate school here and stayed on. One in particular, who I will no doubt see on this trip, I always do see him, will turn to me at some point at a bar late one night this week and say, "Well, T, you ruined my life." That is, by making him into a writer instead of something successful and, remunerative like a lawyer. God knows we need more of those, you know.
It is a tough life, though, for many people. I mean, you seem to have been a success, but for most people it's a matter of agony, rejection. I was talking to Alan Garganis, wrote The Oldest Living Confederate Widow, Tells All, wonderful book. And he said, even up to the pub date, his life was 2 to 3 rejection slips in the mail a week in bills. And he's never earned more than $14,000 a year.
Alan is a good friend of mine. We went to school at Iowa together and, in fact, taught there 2 years ago together at the same time. And I know it took him 10 years to do the book. And he's had a marvelous success with a marvelous book. It's hard to say when a writer will emerge. Yes, I've been very successful, and I've had a lot of gratification and public attention right from the beginning. However, I didn't make a lot of money then either. My object was not to make money, and still isn't. The money is sort of a happy concomitant of getting an audience, and that's what I want most of all. This is, after all, my 7th book, so I've been at it for a while, and I've had my share of rejections, too. In fact, when I began writing, they were so pretty, you know, the rejection ships. They're in, slips. They're in different colors, and they just look so interesting. I began to post them on the walls. I could probably paper the outside of this building with the ones I've got over my career now, so now I keep them in a filing cabinet.
Is that right? How does that make a writer feel? I mean, it must be awfully discouraging to have these,
well,
these things mount up like that.
Often in a question and answer after a reading, of course, the audience is composed entirely of hopeful writers, or with my students, I'll tell them the fact of it is that essentially what you're doing when you send out a piece of fiction to a magazine is attempting to match up that story with the taste of a given person who may be anonymous to you. So you must expect that it probably won't always match up and that you will get rejected. Consider it a business. If you believe in the piece, you think it's finished and that it's good, you might pick 20 magazines, and as it comes back from one, you might try another. I had no connections. I knew no one. I grew up here in New York. I began to send out stories that I was working on in my early 20s and fortunately had some published. I then went on to the Iowa Workshop on the basis of that and just kept plugging away.
Kind of like sending out a resume, isn't it, to 100 companies you'd like to work for?
Yeah, I suppose. It's similar. Yeah.
Well, Gurganis was saying that he, through the efforts of John Cheever, was able to have a story published in The New Yorker, 1974, I think.
We both studied with John Cheever at that time. And, I believe the story is called Minor Heroism of Allen's, a long story and a very good one that Cheever did help him publish in The New Yorker, yeah.
Well, he said that was... That resulted in great celebration, and he thought, boy, my career is off and running, and that was the last thing he ever sold to The New Yorker.
Well, I mean, there's no accounting for the vagaries of taste or for the editors, God bless them. You know, they want what they want. They may exclude certain people for reasons that we're not aware of, but that's no reason to give up. In Allen's case, it paid off. He stayed there working for 10 years, and he's got himself a wonderful book out of it. As I said earlier, it was a little easier for me psychologically because I was producing books all during that period, mm-hmm. and they were getting a warm reception. And I've seen my audience grow geometrically, actually, with each given book. So it's great.
Well, is it a workshop you teach?
I do indeed.
And at the opening of the workshop, when your students file in, do you give them the facts of life that... 90% of you probably will never have anything published?
Well, that's not my call to make. It's hard to tell what a person of 20 will do, or even a person of 40, and I have people of all ages in the class. Or 50, hey. I mean, it's hard to tell what they'll do. I don't presume to make that judgment. The ones who are obviously very talented, I encourage. The ones who are not, I try to be kind to, but don't encourage. Many of my students have gone on to be writers. Many have gone on to work in publishing. In fact, one just joined the Viking organization, which pleases me enormously, and one sells my books for Penguin in San Francisco. even if they don't go into writing or publishing, I think the students will at least have more of an appreciation for literature and perhaps be part of the audience that we need.
Also, it would seem to me that in a creative writing course, the benefits go far beyond perhaps publishing a story or a novel, because you're dealing with words. You learn how to express yourself better and to be more aware of the things around you.
I suppose there's that. There's also the fact that you're confronted with an art and you're working in an art form, just as you take finger painting in kindergarten. It's part of your development. A lot of academic courses don't allow much freedom of expression, so I think it's very liberating, actually. And this may explain why the creative writing programs have proliferated so across the United States in the last decade.
It's really a dumb name, creative writing, isn't it?
Plus, how do you describe yourself if you are a writer? You know, if you say a writer, people wonder, well, do you work for the newspaper? What do you do? Well, you say, well, you can specialize. I'm a short storyist, you can tell them, or I'm a novelist, or I'm a poet. I think poet is about the best, actually, the best description.
Yeah, I think people probably lose sight of the fact that a writer is an artist in the same way that a painter is an artist. You know, your canvas is the page.
Well done. Let's say that some writers are artists.
No, for sure.
Sometimes when I look at the bestseller list, I wonder, you know. Not to be facetious about it. Yeah, I consider myself an artist. I work probably 4 or 5 hours a day, tapping that subconscious part of the mind which enables you to create a work, to envision and create it.
When you write, do you find that the story builds pretty much? I mean, you can, of course, outline a story in the way a mystery novelist would do, so everything is tightly controlled and you know how that's going to end. But
I can't imagine how anybody could do that, including mystery novelists. I think the work has to grow organically. You begin with a subject, an idea that you're interested in, absorb yourself in it, like, of course, the grueling trip I mentioned to Georgia and then the side trip to Battle Creek and also a trip I made to Japan. And a voice will occur to you and you begin. And I think the process of making a novel is to discover where it's going and what you mean to say. I think if you already know what you mean to say, you may as well be writing in a newspaper. You may as well write an editorial or be a political writer. I think especially when you've written several books, as I have, you begin to discover what you're all about, what you stand for, what your politics are, who you like, who you don't, etc.
You said you went to Japan. Was this to get an idea of the culture of your main character? Hiro
Tanaka, my main character, whose father was a hippie who visited Japan briefly.
A long nose,
butter stinker, like the rest of us, a gaijin. And he did not know his father. When the book opens, Hiro is 20, leaving Japan in order to escape the racial prejudice he faces there, because the Japanese society is a very closed one. Most of what I know about the Japanese, I know from living in Los Angeles and from doing a lot of reading into the sociology of Japan. I did visit Japan, giving a number of readings around the country for 2 weeks last summer. A year ago. But the book was about three quarters done by then. What I learned from being in Japan, I think it probably informs the book throughout in its final draft. But basically, it's an imagined Japan. Just as when I wrote Water Music, I imagined Africa. I think that, from my point of view anyway, fiction is an exercise of the imagination, just to see where it'll take you, what you can do. And yes, I put some polar opposites together in this book in order to see what would happen. In fact, if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind reading the two epigraphs for the radio audience so they can get an idea of, you know, how the book comes together. I chose an epigraph first from Yukio Mishima, and it goes like this. Those who wish to live horribly and die horribly are choosing a beautiful way of life. Now, I've always subscribed to that, haven't you, Don?
Let me think about that.
And the second one is from Joel Chandler Harris's Uncle Remus Tales. Bred and born in de Briar Patch, Brer Fox. Bred and born. You know, in a story that I love the happy accident that I found the two quotes and put them together. In a story that's about where you belong, what is your place in society, and et cetera, and other things that it entails, like racism and doors that are shut to you. I thought these two were particularly telling. The Uncle Remus quote, I hope people remember the tale of Br'er Rabbit and the Tar Baby. Br'er Rabbit, these are the words that he says to Br'er Fox after he convinces him that would be the worst torture ever, to throw him back in that briar patch. And he says, that's where I was bred and born.
I'm not going to give away the ending. I kind of had hoped, as everything built, that somehow Hiro's father would be located in some form, probably working at a Goodyear store, something like that, no longer a hippie, and and that they become reunited and saved, and this was not to happen. I was a little disappointed.
You're a very sweet person and you like happy endings. I like happy endings, too, but in my own...
I like grade B movies.
Yeah, me too, sure. I love the old movies from, the, you know, the 40s where everything is great. We don't have any AIDS. We don't have any homeless. We don't have Saddam Hussein. Everything works. Nothing's broken down. There's infinite supplies of everything we want. But unfortunately, I don't think you can view the world in those terms anymore. My ambition in this book was to create a very likable hero in Hiro Tanaka, someone whom you would root for. And if I've maybe pulled the rug out from under you at the end, perhaps it is for that poignance you mentioned at the outset.
By the same token, you could always say, well, look, you don't like my ending? Here, you write it. You like the book.
Well, you know, it's funny. I gave a reading at New Pulse this past spring, and apparently the graduate classes there had just been studying World's End, so they knew it very well, probably better than I know it now. And the first question from the audience was by a girl who was, like you, disappointed because she wanted things to work out. And in my view, sometimes, or most often, they don't, you know. And happy endings are just too neat. They don't fit in with my worldview. Anyway, she said, wouldn't it have been better if Walter Van Brunt, the hero of that novel, had resisted this doom in his blood and risen above it? And I told her that I couldn't imagine a more appropriate, fitting, beautiful, and poignant ending than the one I'd written. But that if she were to write the novel, that would be her prerogative to have that sort of ending. But in my view, it wasn't right.
But I'm sure it gave you a great deal of satisfaction to know that she had indeed read it.
Yeah. Read it closely and carefully, sure. I mean, I'm often facetious in what I say, but I do really relate to my audience, and I'm very happy to have an audience, and I'm always patient with and friendly with the people who write me letters, all of which I've answered all my life. Of course, I'm no John Updike. I don't get 3,000 a day, but I do answer them with people I meet at readings and so on, with people who come up to me on the street and say, aren't you Michael Jackson? No. Aren't you T.C. Boyle? I say, sure. And it's always been really nice. I've been a fan of literature all my life. Still am, of course. And I like the fact that people are relating to my work, reading it, enjoying it. It's the biggest satisfaction that you can get out of being an artist, I think.
Do you read your old work, like Water Music?
I've never reread the old work, no. I think, well, first of all, there's so many books by other people to read. I don't have time. Secondly, I think an artist wants to look ahead. If you were to read an old book, well, then maybe you'd start to replicate yourself again, and I think that's the kiss of death. Without mentioning any names, I think there are several writers we've both admired over the years who seem to write the same book over and over ad nauseum until the public loses interest. Maybe they have some private thing to work out, but...
Well, there's something else, too.
Yeah.
You look at something you've written before, and you might say, with the perspective of years, gee, I wish I'd done that differently. Robert Lowell, the poet, was like that. He would pick up one of his poems, and he couldn't put it down again. That's why I think he wrote a collection of poetry called Notebook, and that was published in about 3 or 4 different editions.
Hmm. Yeah, I was aware of that.
Changing the poems, and in some instances, actually made them worse.
Yeah, well, there's a Freudian term for that. It's called anal retentiveness. I like to feel that you work as hard as you can in the most concentrated manner you can on a given work, whether it be a story or a novel, until you feel it's as good as you can make it. Then you let it go, give it to the public, and work on the next one. Because what is most satisfying for me, anyway, and I think for many artists, is the process of creating a work. The idea that you have something to get up for in the morning, something to inform your life, something to do. I would hate to have to think that there might be something wrong with a work that could be changed if I would only think about it long enough and hold on to it long enough. I would rather be working in a concentrated way as much as possible to the end and put out a work of art that I think is as good as I can make it. Maybe it does have flaws. I don't think any work of art is perfect. But that's part of the human condition and part of what you have to recognize in yourself as an artist.
You still... working with that old typewriter?
Sure am. Still working with it.
Whoa.
Although now, in the room adjoining that, is a big, fine, fat, fancy new computer word processor, which I use often to rest my elbow on when I'm talking on the phone.
Slow, you gotta copy it again. And,
yeah, we've talked about this before. I know, Don. I think if you're comfortable with the way you're working, perhaps the rhythm of that is part of the creation of a given work. The only thing that would speed me up if I were working on the word processor would be to do that final copy, press the button, and let it print. I spend about six weeks on East is East, for instance, typing a final perfect finished draft, you know, on erasable paper. It's a very antiquated thing to do, I know. But those 6 weeks are very satisfying for me. I'm not saying that occasionally I don't get bored when I'm typing over a page. It's perfect. I may make minor adjustments and clean things up here and there. But it's a time,
what
I think...
What if you want to insert four paragraphs in the middle of this? It doesn't throw everything off if we type all those pages.
Well, I can always negotiate with my editor, you know, give her back $10 from
you. You can negotiate.
No, that's not a problem, really. Usually by the time I get to the final draft, it's been reworked so much, page by page, line by line, it's pretty much done. I don't make major structural changes. Again, I think that's a result of working, as we spoke earlier, in an organic way, of the work building itself as it goes along.
Well, I was trying to talk James Dickey into buying a computer. He collects typewriters, so he was telling me he has a typewriter in almost every room, and he has something going in each typewriter. And he was saying that he couldn't use a computer because he likes to see each successive draft of a poem that he writes. And I said, well, you can do that.
Well, I was...
You can do that on a computer.
Sure.
Then he said, but I'll have to learn to use a computer. And he didn't want to learn it, and it's tough, you know, it's not easy to do to change the habits of a life.
Well, I do know how to use it, and I do occasionally use it for things like a Vita, for instance, you know, where it might change each year because you have more publications and more awards and so on. And then instead
what?
A Vita, a curriculum Vita you know, your life's work and education and so on. Something like that, it's wonderful for. You just insert the new material and print a new copy. But I can sympathize with James Dickey. The way that you've learned to work is somehow ingrained in you. Now, a man who interests me in this respect is John Updike, who is a generation preceding mine and writes his fiction in longhand. However, he writes his reviews on a computer.
I guess he doesn't take the reviews as seriously as his fiction.
I don't know. I really don't know. I would suspect that it's because he feels more relaxed with the fiction in that format.
Well, T.C. Boyle, it's another terrific book, East is East. I had a ball reading it, and I know this is going to be another effort to expand your ever-growing audience.
Well, thank you, Don. We haven't mentioned how absolutely gut-wrenchingly hilarious it is, either.
Did we mention that? Yes, I said it was both funny and poignant.
Oh, good. Well, yeah, I think that's an accurate description.
Well, it's a terrific book. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be.